Uncensored consumer reporting is in serious trouble in Chicago. The past 2.5 years, Roberta Raskin has been investigating housing, energy, food pricing, and other problems confronted daily by consumers over the NBC-owned and operated TV station there. She's been critical of such companies as Standard Oil, Chrysler, Procter & Gamble, Nabisco. However, Roberta will be no more. She's being fired because they said she is an advocate, not objective. Well, Roberta, come on down to Austin. We'll put you on Alternative Views News Magazine. This very early Alternative Views program from September 1979, we focus on the giant oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, particularly focusing on the handling of the situation by the mass media, especially the local TV stations. Campeche Bay, Gulf of Mexico, June 3, 1979. An offshore oil well blows out. The rig, owned by Pemex, Mexico's state-run petroleum operation, is shown here moments after the blowout. Experts and equipment are rushed to the site to try to cap the runaway well and contain the huge oil slick. First reports are hopeful that the well can be brought under control. But efforts to plug the well, spewing as much as 20,000 barrels of oil a day, prove unsuccessful. Slowly, steadily, and relentlessly, the spill migrates northward and finally comes ashore on the Texas coast at South Padre Island. Cleanup operations are begun, but marine biologists fear that the area's problems are far from over and that the fish, lobster, shrimp, and oyster-rich Gulf coastal waters have been contaminated indefinitely. The spill has reached the governor's mansion, where it was learned that SEDCO, the company which leased the drilling rig to Pemex, was founded by the governor of Texas, William Clements, and is now headed by Clements' son.
Welcome once again to Alternative Views. Tonight we're going to get the story behind those facts that you've just seen. And with us on tonight's program to help share with us a perspective that you probably haven't been offered in the establishment media is Philip Russell for an encore performance. He's the author of Mexico in Transition. Welcome, Phil.
Well, thank you.
And also Doug Kellner. Doug has been doing a lot of research on the ecological disaster and some of the connections between William Clements and SEDCO, etc. But before that, we'll do some news as usual.
Well, we start off with oil, as usual. Anybody know Tony Clifford? Well, he produces solar cells, technically called photovoltaics, and he's been resisting the big oil companies. They want to buy out his company because Tony has the ability to convert abundant sunlight into electricity. The oil companies now own 8 of the 9 major photovoltaic firms. And Exxon, Arco, soon going to control more than half of the industry. But The photovoltaic cell is not the only technological outfit being absorbed by these giant energy firms. 12 of the top 25 solar companies are controlled by firms with annual sales greater than $1 billion. These include Exxon, General Electric, General Motors, Alcoa, Grumman, Westinghouse, et cetera, et cetera. The same old friends. But as a sidelight, well, it's really not a sidelight, but it's another angle of this. Besides absorbing all of these companies, the oil firms have also made less conspicuous moves to gain control of solar industry's growth, because the Achilles heel, apparently, is copper, and particularly with solar transistors. So what has happened that the oil industry now has increased its control of copper production domestically to 63%. Isn't that beautiful?
I wonder what control they have of Chile's copper industry under Pinochet and the junta. I wonder if they're making deals with him.
Remember last week we talked about the AFL-CIO calling for nationalization of the oil industry? Well, now the UAW president, Douglas Frazier, said it's time to put the oil companies and their political lies on notice that the American people have had it. He said they should create a federal corporation to seek, drill, and refine oil on public lands and to tax excessive profits, etc. It seems that in other articles I've read about the unions, that the unions apparently fearing the trend, which has been anti-union, not only government and business over the past few years, but also the union membership dropping off severely over the past few decades, they are becoming more militant now, perhaps to attract some greater following. Or maybe it's being forced upon them by the realities of the
situation.
Well, Frank, there really are only three solutions to the energy crisis. We can let things continue as they have been, which is a lot of fun for all of us. They can nationalize the oil industry, or they can enforce the antitrust laws, and it doesn't seem like any three of those are a likely probability, given our Congress. Well, I have some information on John Connolly, who's, of course, running for president again. For those of you who need some historical background, particularly in some of his shadier aspects, back during the milk scandal, there was a gentleman from San Antonio who was found innocent of giving a bribe to John Connolly, found guilty of giving the bribe to John Connolly, and of course Connolly was later acquitted of accepting that bribe, which is an interesting point of law when you stop and think about Party A, who has stolen something from a homeowner, sells it to Party B, and then, of course, the police, you know, crack down and they catch Party B. Well, they find Party B innocent of receiving the stolen goods from Party A, who has been found guilty of stealing the goods. But, of course, the reason that John Connolly was found innocent, give you an insight into government prosecution of these key cases, is that they chose to prosecute with a Wisconsin law professor who hadn't set foot in a courtroom for 14 years. And against this representation on the government side, we had Edward Bennett Williams representing Connolly, one of the top criminal attorneys in the country. So needless to say, the government wanted to enforce the law, but not equally for different classes of people. Well, this involves Connolly's role in granting some suspicious bank charters when he was Secretary of the Treasury. And a copyrighted story in the Dallas Morning News Sunday the 16th by Earl Gotz, who was one of the best investigative reporters in the country. It seems like there were seven charters approved while Connolly was Secretary of the Treasury. Now, of course, the Comptroller of Currency, who at the time was William B. Camp, is responsible for granting these charters. But the reason I'm mentioning this story is because several of these banks operate locally here in Austin. The seven banks in question are Lovefield National Bank of Dallas, Chevy Chase National Bank of Austin, the Guarantee National Bank of Houston, Metropolitan National Bank of Houston, People's National Bank in Spring Branch, and the First National Bank in Round Rock, and the Meadowbrook National Bank in Fort Worth. The interesting thing about the case is that the staff had recommended against the granting of charters in all of these cases for various reasons. And the comptroller usually never goes against the recommendations of his staff, although he did at this time. And the reasons seem to be politically motivated. As it boils down, Connolly's son and seven of his former aides are shareholders in the Lovefield National Bank of Dallas. The investigation is continuing, although the Senate Banking Committee has been releasing suggestions or press releases to the effect that Connolly will eventually be found innocent of any wrongdoing. One of the interesting things about this is some of the quotes of an Austin source who was very knowledgeable about Texas power politics. It was common knowledge in Washington that bank charters could be gotten in Texas through camp, if they could be gotten. You either got them or you didn't get them through camp. That is unusual that he was appointed by Johnson and then reappointed by Nixon. Now, the point to that is that Connally intervened to make sure that Camp continued as comptroller of the currency. Especially in that very critical area of political patronage, the ability to get a bank charter or deny one is a very powerful political weapon. Well, the Dallas Morning News tried to reach John Connally for his side of the story, and the only response they've gotten so far is that since Camp is dead, there will be no statement forthcoming. Frank?
Well, we opened the program with a bit of censorship, that of getting rid of a woman who was too critical of various businesses in Chicago. The American Health Care Association doesn't like some of the lines that are in the script of Lou Grant. The one entitled Home, in which various nursing home practices are portrayed in a negative light. And when the episode was first played in February, the AHCA tried unsuccessfully to stop the show. And now they're mounting a big campaign to prevent the rerun of the episode.
It failed, by the way. They did show the rerun, but it was discussed quite a bit in a lot of media publications, this pressure to not show it, because it portrayed nursing homes as not being adequate to take care of the needs of the patients. I actually did a study of nursing homes in Austin, and it was scandalous, the conditions of a lot of the nursing homes in America. And on Lou Grant, the show is very mild in criticizing nursing homes, but even mild criticisms, this National Association of Nursing Home couldn't take, which is peculiar. They would make a big deal about it.
Which just made it worse for them, probably. You don't have a feel for how many affiliates may have buckled under, because they had a big drive out. They couldn't get CBS to drop it. Then they tried to go after individual affiliates.
I haven't seen a report on that. I didn't read that any affiliates buckled, but this is a danger in network television, that if these pressure groups can't get the national networks not to show a program, they put pressure on affiliates. For instance, there was a program in Austin on chemicals. It was a hard-hitting look at the effect of chemicals on the environment, of the disposing of chemicals and some of the pollution that was done. And the Austin station was pressured into not showing this movie during prime time. They showed it instead on Sunday. So this is an increasing tendency of putting pressure on affiliates not to show controversial programs. And I hope affiliates will stand the line on this.
Well, speaking of CBS, you've got something there on CBS.
Yeah, Frank, this is close to your home. This was in the September 7th issue of the Wall Street Journal. CBS, of course, is in the market for some tasty little goodie to purchase, since their profits are at record highs. It seems like they have been under, for the last few weeks, negotiations with Crum & Forster, which is a tremendously big, diversified financial institution. The interesting thing about this article is that they mentioned that in one day alone, Crum & Forster's price, after the announcement that there was a possible merger between CBS and Crum & Forster, which is basically insurance. Now, after the mention of this merger, of course, Crum & Forster's stock jumped up $3.75 a share in a single day. Of course, trading was suspended. The interesting thing about this is that there were only 39,000 shares traded during the day. Now, Crum & Forster has about 13.5 million shares outstanding. And in no way possible, in an ordinary market with ordinary supply and demand conditions, if you can believe that, operating, would you have that significant, that big of a price jump with only 39,000 out of 13.5 million shares being traded. This seems to point to specialists. For those of you unaware of what specialists are, these are the people who actually buy and sell the stocks on behalf of brokerage houses and other financial concerns on the floor of the exchange. It has long been thought that these specialists operate not only for their own profit, but on behalf of the big investment banking houses, the big brokerage houses, and what have you. Well, after this merger was announced, Crum & Forster has broken off all merger talks, and they have stated that any merger acquisition attempts by CBS in the future will be of a hostile nature, which doesn't mean that the merger will not go through. It just means that it will be a hostile as opposed to a friendly takeover.
But that also means that somebody made a killing on the stock.
Somebody has already made a big killing on the stock. Exactly. Also in the market for something good to purchase is RCA. Of course, RCA is the parent corporation to NBC, one of our free press media representatives, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of ours, of RCA. They are in the process of getting rid of two profitable but not as choice items, such as Banquet Foods and Random House Publishing. Now, these are two going concerns that did make a fairly decent, healthy profit. But that's not exactly what RCA wants. They are in the market right now for CIT, which is another huge financial investment concern, which is primarily into insurance. The asking price at the time is about $1.35 billion. It'll be interesting to see if RCA pays cash, as has been the case with a lot of the mergers going on recently, Frank.
So they're going to let them go, the Banquet Foods and the...
Exactly. And they said there's no relationship between their letting go of those two concerns to take over a much bigger concern.
Well, it seems that that radical analysis attempts to walk on both sides of the street, because years ago I was part of a media group that would criticize RCA for having ownership of a Random House. We felt it was a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
So now we apparently will criticize them for getting rid of it, too.
Well, people say, oh, well, what difference does it make if these media giants are making acquisitions and are conglomerates? We did see a situation, oh, I guess it was about 3 years ago, where ABC, before they made their meteoric rise in profits as well as ratings, they actually decreased the number of documentaries and the amount of money going to the news department because of the loss that their conglomerate interests, their non-broadcasting related interests, had acquired. So they, although ABC was making money itself, they siphoned some of that money off for their other interests. Well, we've had some programs on several occasions, well, a couple of times. We've had programs on civil liberties, civil rights, and we very frequently cover this type of story, particularly as it affects minorities. It seems that blacks in Cleveland are still angry after going through a week under siege at the hands of what one local figure called an FBI execution squad. The pretext for the attack, which included searches of 150 homes by official accounts, was the August 9th killing of a white FBI agent by a black man. There were over 100 police brutality complaints made to the NAACP, and the black city councilman charged that the police swarming all over the place were like stormtroopers, kicking down doors and pulling guns on little kids. Then there was another story, this one in New York. There was a man, Luis Baez, who was mentally disturbed. He's 26 years old. He was in his house and he was cutting up the kitchen floor with a pair of scissors. Well, pleas failed to bring him under control by his mother, Rosa, so she asked the police to come. Well, when confronted by the police, Baez spooked out and he fled to a fire escape, and according to police, Baez lunged at them with his scissors. They shot him 16 times.
I was in New York when that happened, Frank.
Oh.
Yeah, and my sense of what's going on in New York is that from the perspective of police are really being put into a jungle. At that, you have to understand the context. 2 days before that, a policeman was murdered in a bank robbery. There had been several other policemen murdered in the prior month that I was there in New York. A couple days later, after a good deal of community outrage about this and also another police killing of a woman the next day who was brandishing what they felt was a machete, the police commissioner of New York wrote in and said in effect, police should not be blamed for the chronic causes of unemployment, a lack of mental health, unsanitary living conditions, etc. Until we deal with the root causes of that, police are always going to be made the fall guys for society's problems. I think it's important sometimes to look at the kind of job they have. My uncle is a cop and works in the tenements in Brooklyn, and he has come several times very close to killing people just on accidents. You go up into these darkened tenements, two and three floor walk-ups. There are no hallway lights, and people come out with what looks like a gun, and it's actually a flashlight. Until they flash that on, they're only a second away from being having their head blown off. It's a real bad situation.
That's a good point. I was in Brooklyn this summer, and it literally seemed to be a jungle there, the crime and the violence. And I think the police internalize this environment in which you have incredible poverty, incredible suffering, and people are forced into crime for survival, and the policeman internalize this sort of jungle survival struggle strategy, and they have a very dangerous, tense situation there. And I think that's why you've had in the big cities a lot of killings, both of policemen and of minorities by policemen. Mm-hmm. It's really a hot issue in the big cities.
Al, I think you've got a story here on oil before we...
Not that it's any surprise to the American public. Newsday, which has conducted one of the few independent investigations of the recent crises, actually the only independent investigation of the recent crises, has come to the startling conclusion that the Carter administration and the oil companies conspired together to create the crisis because it served mutual ends towards both. Carter and his administration have been trying to tell us that there is an energy crisis and we need to conserve. And so they purposely let the crisis develop and actually fostered the crisis in quite a few instances through the particular types of government regulation, for instance, on jet aviation fuel and a few other things, to foster this thing in the first place. And, of course, the oil companies have made buku bucks, billions of dollars, by the promotion of the crisis as a whole. The basic starting point for those of us who have forgotten for this crisis was the Iranian shortfall, as it's now being called, the shortfall in Iranian oil, which started back around February because of the revolution in Iran. But the evidence is out from the Department of Commerce and Department of Labor and others that the shortfall in Iranian production was more than matched by imports or exports from other OPEC nations. So while we're being told that the reason for the gasoline crisis and the oil crisis of this past summer was because of the drop in Iranian production, the facts and figures that the government itself had in its very hands suggest that the OPEC nations had increased by more than enough to compensate. In short, there never was a real crisis at hand, although there certainly was an increase in price and gas lines and what have you. These are things that, as long as the oil industry continues the way it is, that we're going to have to get used to. And they used to happen every 10 years or so, and now the frequency seems to be every 3 or 4 years. In the 80s, they might come every year or so until something is done.
Say, would anybody take $20 million to sell their island to the government if they gave it to you? And if you would only pay $15,000 for it to start out with?
Is that a rhetorical question, Frank?
Well, there's a fellow out in Hawaii who's in this situation. The U.S. government offered him $20 million to sell Palmyra Island so that the U.S. could use it and other countries could use it as a nuclear waste dump. He said, you can go dump your waste somewhere else. And there was a Texas state legislator, Ron Waters, introduced a bill that would require utilities to store their nuclear wastes in their corporate executive suites.
I'm all for that.
That sounds good. Well, let's find out what's happening with oil and other slimy creatures.
When we began researching the oil spill, we discovered a consistent pattern of media coverage. Most of the standard accounts of the oil spill emphasize the what happened, the who done it, and the who's responsible angle. As important as these aspects may be, we felt that certain questions, troubling questions, were being consistently ignored. So tonight on Alternative Views, we thought we'd go through some of those unasked questions point by point. The first question, is it true that the oil spill no longer poses an environmental hazard? Doug Kellner interviewed members of the faculties of the departments of geology and marine biology at the University of Texas, and this is what he found.
Experts say that there still is oil on the bottom of the sea, and that even though the major tides are now moving, supposedly, back to Mexico so that the giant oil slick will probably not hit the Texas coast again, at least until possibly next year, nonetheless, there's so much oil on the bottom of the sea, the tide could still wash it up on the beach. Moreover, there's already been some very harmful short-term effects on the environment to fish and birds. The marine biology expert said that she saw loads of shrimp that were contaminated, that the fish had been poisoned. Moreover, experts that had analyzed the oil told me that it was, in their words, quote, highly volatile. What that meant was that it's a type of oil that's very poisonous. Moreover, it's a poison that is hard to detect in fish, so that some of these shrimp boats may pass through the inspection. They may not be able to detect the poison in it, so then you have a danger to human beings that eat it. Moreover, we've already seen a lot of pictures of birds who were dying because certain birds eat fish out of the sea, and they get drenched in the oil, and they can't fly, and then they die. But what these ecology experts are really worried about are the long-term effects on the environment, the long-term effects on plant, animal, bird, and sea life. For one thing, the shrimp beds may be destroyed by the oil that's now on the bottom of the sea. Moreover, there is a big breeding ground for different wildlife like whooping cranes and turtles on the South Texas coast, and it could be that their breeding grounds are polluted, because even though they have cleaned the oil off the beaches so it's not visible, I've been told that it has seeped beneath the sand and has possibly harmed some breeding grounds. That,
Doug? I wanted to interject that there's only been one spill of this size that scientists have had a good opportunity to study, and that was the Amoco Cadiz, which broke up off the coast of Normandy. And of course the point of the study was to see how much of the oil they could actually track down, how much was scraped off the beaches and how much was scraped off the ocean, and after all, and how much was left in the tanker. Well, of course we're not dealing with a tanker here, we're dealing with something that is pumping it directly from the floor. But the point was, even this was something that they should have been able to account for, all of the oil. When the final results were in, they were missing 33% of the oil. And they theorized, and later it's been confirmed, that this oil has mingled with the sand at the bottom of the ocean. Now, the significance of this is that these are some of the best oyster beds in the world, and that they are going to be damaged indefinitely for the next 20 or 30 years because of the slow seepage of this deadly poison from the sands back into the water over the next 20 or 30 years.
And will that actually kill off the oyster?
It'll make,
or will it poison them so if people try to eat them?
It'll poison them so that people eat them that they'll be consuming.
In the course of our conversation, we also learned from Phil Russell about the hazards of offshore drilling in Mexico.
But if you read the Mexican press regularly, you constantly hear about very serious problems that are similar to what we're now reading about on Padre Island, but since it was in Mexico, nobody was paying any attention to it. They've polluted rivers, they've silted rivers up, they've dumped oil in it, they've dumped chemicals, and in fact, in reading the Mexican studies of what the impact of this particular oil spill is, that constantly they come up with a conclusion that it's very hard to gauge the impact of this particular spill because there's so many petrochemical pollutants being dumped into the Gulf at various points along the line that once the water flows a little ways down the line, it's very difficult to determine just where the pollutant is coming from. And so their whole policy is very destructive of the environment.
Of all the scientists that I talked to asking about the ecological effects, I asked many of them, what was the effects on Mexico? They didn't know anything. In other words, they didn't even care what the ecological damage was to Mexico, and I've read nothing about that, whereas they were just concerned with the danger to the South Texas coast.
This prompted a question that has been one of the focal points of media coverage. Is Mexico responsible for the oil spill?
You look at past precedent, we are not on any moral grounds to demand any payment for them, and there's a very glaring example in the history of U.S.-Mexican relations which points this out, that there was, during World War II, a treaty signed dealing with waters coming from the Colorado River and emptying into the Gulf of California, just south of California. And we signed this treaty and specified that Mexico would get a certain amount of water each year. And then in the 60s, when the demands on the Colorado River water were much higher, there simply wasn't any water left to give to everybody. And so we started sending Mexico salt water in the quantity stipulated in the treaty, but it was salt water that we'd used to rinse out fields which had been irrigated and had grown salty. And we started sending them this water without even notifying them in advance. And a tremendous amount of cropland was destroyed by this salt water which suddenly appeared. And when Mexico demanded compensation for this willful act which didn't receive any advance notice, the United States government refused compensation. And again, the shoe fits on both feet. When you have contamination coming from the United States into Mexico, the United States has refused to pay it. And so again, I think that might be the best comment we could say on responsibility.
Putting aside, for the moment, the question of responsibility, we asked Bill Russell why, given the obvious risk of offshore oil exploration, does Mexico continue to drill?
The extent revolves around why Mexico is so rapidly trying to increase its oil production. I think that is very directly related to the lifestyle in the United States. We have developed or been sold, quite often through the media that we're using now, been sold a lifestyle that involves our freeways, our air conditioners, and of course that requires a lot of energy. We, to a large extent, have exhausted our own domestic energy sources, and that means we go abroad. And so there's tremendous pressure on Mexico through the loans it can get and through a lot of different corporations to very rapidly produce this oil. And so this oil spill is one byproduct of the energy demands which our lifestyle is putting on Mexico.
We asked Russell about those pressures, both internal and external.
The pressure, Mexico is very much in debt, and it has its creditors want the money, and of course that money can come through oil. And also, the Mexican government wants to develop its own economy, which again involves oil. Not only is our energy demand very closely tied into the Mexican oil development, but much of it is financed by loans from the United States. Just in this past week, the Bank of America, along with 68 other banks, concluded a $2.5 billion loan deal to Pemex for oil development. And again, most of the hardware that's used in developing their oil comes from American corporations. The technology Mexico is using to develop itself with economically, and it's had a tremendous success over the last 20 years in terms of economic growth, but that technology is a virtual carbon copy of what we find up here to a large extent because that development is controlled by subsidiaries of U.S. corporations.
Phil? This led us into a discussion of the interest or conflict of interest of one of these American corporations, SEDCO.
Mexico, as is the case with most of the underdeveloped world, simply doesn't have this very sophisticated hardware that's necessary for offshore oil exploration. In fact, the United States is by far the leader in the world in developing this technology and actually possessing the hardware. And so the Mexican government, in order to develop its oil deposits on offshore areas in the Gulf of Mexico, simply leased these drilling platforms from SEDCO in order to drill the well. And a very interesting aspect of this is that the head of the Mexican Pemex, Díaz Serrano, also founded his own private company called Permargo, and it was Permargo which leased the rig from SEDCO and in turn subleased it to Pemex. And of course, as is very common in Mexico, you find public officials also playing a private role in profiting from their own decisions. And of course, that raises a whole conflict of interest and the reliability of any investigation that Mexico comes up with, because here the government's investigating its own company and the head of that company is very closely involved in the leasing of the rig, which subsequently blew out.
I wonder, though, in the whole notion of we constantly talk about conflict of interest. I mean, in our country, it's no shame to be a businessman and be recruited into government. Bill Clements ran on a platform of being a businessman. He was going to be a pragmatic administrator. He was going to be non-ideological. He was going to be a tight money manager. They ran, and apparently the people of Texas thought that was a good idea to have him. What's wrong with having businessmen? And if they're businessmen, they're obviously going to have prior connections. And if something comes up in it, why do we yell conflict of interest all the time?
I think the specific thing is trying to wear two hats at once. Obviously, you have people in government with business experience because they, you know, our country is basically run by private companies that where people develop the experience. But the reason for worrying about conflict of interest is that when they have two hats, that they won't be able, the assumption is, to make unbiased expenditures with public money while they're profiting at the same time.
Well, isn't that a presumption instead of looking at of painting a picture of sort of the Black Knight and seeking instead to have perhaps a crusade to put in, to replace them with a White Knight? Perhaps we should be looking at the notion of whether or not government is neutral. Every day, government goes out of its way to legally promote business, whether it be the relaxation of auto emission standards, or the underwriting of the nuclear power industry, or price supports, or you name it through. I mean, shouldn't we? It seems to me that the line between business as usual, that means the kind of things we openly call legal support of the business community, and to incur incentives to business, and what we call scandal is kind of shadowy.
Oh, I agree. I think, you know, that Nelson Rockefeller's banks were no more benevolent before he became vice president and then had his own built-in conflicts of interest. And so often in this conflict of interest, we look for the one bad guy and we don't say, what does this whole business establishment do to the society?
But isn't that a sort of a limitations of the muckraker form of journalism, investigative journalism, that sort of is always looking for, well, who is going to make personal gain out of this? I know 60 Minutes is constantly looking for what's the angle, who's made a few bucks out of this, looking not at the broader questions of the relationship between government and business, which is to me is much more fundamental and much more troubling.
One of the most striking features of the media coverage of the oil spill is its failure to raise questions about the wisdom of offshore drilling in the first place. To get another view, we spoke to Stuart Hirsch of the Citizen Labor Energy Coalition.
Is offshore drilling a necessary and inevitable part of our energy future?
I think that the recently released Harvard study, a study conducted by the Harvard Business School over a six-year period, suggests that the risks involved in offshore drilling, which have led to the recent spill, are not reasonable and need not be taken. I think that the important way to conceptualize this situation is to say that imported oil, natural gas, coal, and nuclear are the kinds of conventional energy sources that have so many political, economic, and social problems associated with them that they no longer can be the only sources we turn to as a way of meeting the energy needs of the United States and in fact, the Western world. I think two sources that have received too little attention that the Harvard study points to are conservation energy and solar energy. And the Harvard study suggests that if we begin to look at energy conservation as a form of energy generation itself, as a way of decreasing our reliance on more conventional energy sources, and begin to plow in the kinds of incentives, both in terms of tax credits and in terms of other incentives, relaxations of the impediments, the institutional impediments to the development of the conservation technology, that we can use conservation and we can use solar as two energy sources to, in both the short run and the long run, bring us out of the so-called energy crisis that we're now in. I think that one of the problems that exist is that the people who are doing the energy planning, whether they be in the private sector in terms of the coal planners or the oil planners or the nuclear power planners, and those in the public sector, have been so locked into conventional resources and thinking about conventional resources that they've become totally unwilling to examine whether those resources continue to be economically feasible, safe, and whether they will in fact meet the energy needs that this nation continues to face. It's fairly clear to me that the policy implications of the Harvard study would be a very difficult pill for those involved in the oil industry to swallow. But in fact, it may be an easier pill for those of us in the public who must utilize this energy resource, must pay for this energy resource. It's a much easier pill for us to swallow because in the long run, it will provide us with a much cheaper and safer energy source than those that were being offered at the present time.
In another interview, we spoke to Harry Cleaver of the Economics Department of the University of Texas. Cleaver provides a provocative challenge to the assumptions which have become an article of faith among business, government, and media alike, namely that the U.S. must have energy, whatever the cost, because there exists an energy crisis.
What is being argued by the oil companies and energy policymakers in this country is that such oil spills have to be expected,
because it's necessary to proceed with the most rapid possible production of oil and other energy supplies. It's very similar to the kind of argument that is made about nuclear energy. True, it is said, there are certain risks of release of radioactive materials. True that there are problems with the disposal of radioactive waste. Nevertheless, the need for energy is so great that we have to proceed with all possible speed to increase production of energy of all sorts, in particular nuclear energy and oil. In other words, the argument is behind the oil spill is that the problems of dealing with it are really not that important, and that's what Bill Clement said, much ado about nothing, that the real issue is production. So what one has to decide is whether or not that argument is true. Is it true that we have such an energy crisis that we have to go at all speed despite the risk in producing energy, and that the public must bear the cost if there are accidents? I don't think that's true, and I don't think that in the end that really is the issue at all either, because I don't think there is an energy shortage. Much of the discussion right now, it seems to me, is not well thought out. The oil companies are being attacked for having taken undue risk in the Gulf of Mexico. The situation which resulted in the oil slick, the situation is reminiscent of the film The China Syndrome, in which the nuclear industry, faced with the possibility of rupture in its safety systems, goes ahead with the operation of the plant despite the risk. Now this is a situation which seems to me requires analysis, because business is not normally a rational means of operating. The way in which it approaches running its operations does not want to take undue risk. It wants to realize profits on successful production. It does not want to see oil spread all over the Gulf of Mexico that it could be using to make profits on, to sell. It doesn't want to see a meltdown in a nuclear reactor when it could be making profits off the electricity generated by that reactor. So why do they take the risk? That's the question. One of the major questions seems to me raised by this incident. It's one raised by the Harrisburg incident, by Three Mile Island. And I think the answer to that does not come from an analysis of the psychological propensities and the unserious attitudes of business, of the nuclear industry or the oil industry. It comes from the pressures under which the energy companies are under to raise production in what they consider to be safe areas, areas that they have firm control over. Because the biggest source of energy in the United States, which is the coal industry, they do not have control over. They do not have safe control over. And failure to control coal output, as witnessed by the recent long history of wildcat strikes, the big strike 110 days a year or so ago, that has made it necessary for the energy industry to shift its emphasis of operations. Indeed, it throws it into a panic to shift into those areas where you have small amounts of labor, where that labor is better controlled, and to increase output as fast as possible. The other major source of energy is, of course, the Persian Gulf. Foreign oil, Iranian oil, Saudi Arabian oil. And the events of the last year and a half have added urgency to the problem of energy producers because of the rupture of the supply of energy in Iran, a supply of energy which was supposed to be safe and going to be safe for the next 100 years, suddenly disappeared because of the revolution in Iran. And as an NBC white paper on oil and American power argued a couple of weeks ago, the ramifications of that unexpected social upheaval are spread throughout the Persian Gulf area. There's now serious discussion as to whether or not Saudi Arabia is a safe producer of oil. Now, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the other Persian Gulf producers were the major sources of oil throughout the Western world, of cheap oil in the post-war period on which rapid growth was built. The loss of control over cheap oil abroad and over coal production at home, it seems to me, is one of the major reasons why the oil industry and government backing it up, the nuclear industry, are pushing ahead as rapidly as possible, taking risk that they would not otherwise take, in order to bring online enough energy to allow them to outflank those sectors of the energy field over which they have less control. In short, the energy policies being followed by the energy industry and the government right now are to produce an energy sector in which energy is scarce, unsafe, and expensive. What the people of this country, and I think others, are demanding is a total reversal of that policy to one in which energy becomes abundant, safe, and cheap. The refusal to pay increased prices, the resistance to deregulation, the explosions of the sort that we saw at Levittown during the summer against the restriction of gasoline supply is a refusal of the overall energy policies being put forward by the energy industry and the government to demand abundant, safe, and cheap energy is to demand a total reorganization of not only the energy sector, but the economic relationships in the country as a whole.
In the interest of equal time, we invited two reporters, George Waldrop of KTBC and Steve Greenhow of KVUE, who covered the Texas oil spill, to share with us their perspective on the media's handling of the spill.
It was, by its very nature, a story that had the elements of a disaster, say a big 16-alarm fire like we'd never seen before. On the second hand, it was going to affect people, the people that had businesses on the coast, the people that went there for vacations. On the third hand, it was going to affect the environment. It combined elements of, as you say, we determined what is news. It had three real surefire elements in it: people, the land, and a disaster. It was made to order. It's probably the biggest news story that you could ever want to cover. And that goes back to what you're saying about formula. When you go on a fire, or at least when I do, when I'm riding in the car out to a fire, there are certain things I know I'm going to have. The people's reactions if they live there in the fire. It is an editorial judgment. What do the people sitting at home, like George said, with a can of bear in his hand trying to get the kid to bed, he's got 13 things in his mind, what are you going to put on that screen that will reach out and grab him and put across to him the most important thing that happened in that story?
And, but perhaps what's at issue here is, did you as the media fulfill your responsibility in conveying what was important, what was significant about that oil spill? Was it the oil?
The significance of anything is in the eyes of the viewer, in the eyes of the receiver of the information. That's what I'm saying. We cannot, I can't see myself telling you what is significant without you having the knowledge and understanding of what I'm saying is a myriad of facts.
The difference between facts and opinion, reporting and analysis, was a subject we wrestle with throughout the discussion.
Reports what is happening, and a commentator like Eric Severide comes to mind, Howard K. Smith, and the new guy, George, on CBS, I can't think of his name, McLeish. Those men are quite qualified to sit back and take in all the reports from the reporters and say, well, this means this, that means that. But people like George and I go out and say there were 14 trucks on that fire, three people were injured, $2 million was lost in the fire. And now Archibald McLeish will take this together and say, well, the building codes for apartments in this country are poor. That's analysis as compared to
report. Now, what I would argue is that you've already made an analysis, but a surreptitious analysis. What you've done is allowed bias, the bias of covering a news report in a specific way, but you've covered it over with the rube of objectivity and balance. For instance, why wasn't your coverage of the oil spill, why didn't that become a means to sort of look at, well, why are we pursuing this technology and not alternative technologies if they have the inherent risk of these kind of blowouts with the kind of cost that Georgia has raised here?
Well, I really don't think that's our place. I really don't think that's my place. I was sent down there to measure the effect on people and land. And I'm not an expert on offshore drilling, and I'm certainly not an expert on oceanography. I think that would be something to take in a different tack. You have a focus, and we focused on the land and the people and how that first oil washing ashore was hitting them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to do an in-depth documentary, that's what you do with it. You would go and you'd say, well, look what the oil spill has done from offshore drilling. And then you would explore it like that with some analysis. But I keep getting back to this, but there's a difference between reporting and analysis.
Jack, let me add just a few seconds about this. As far as looking into alternatives and whether offshore drilling is good, I think we've got another problem you have to look at. One, I haven't heard one public hue and cry saying that offshore drilling is bad all of a sudden. The only public hue and cry that's come out of this so far is that who's going to pay for it?
Well, to what extent, though, does the media then shape, though, the public agenda to the point where it becomes self-fulfilling? If you do not draw attention to offshore drilling, make the connection between the blowout and the possibility that we ought to question offshore drilling, does that then become self-fulfilling?
You see, the news business is to report the facts. The news business is not to create the facts. Offshore drilling has been with us for so long that there is no question of whether it is good or bad.
There is no question?
I personally see no question at all.
You personally see no question?
I see no personal question if it is good or bad.
Okay, but does that personal opinion there...
It never gets in my story.
It doesn't get in your story?
No.
Oh.
Because I'm not addressing that point.
That's the focus of the talk. Yeah. You can't just shotgun the whole thing. You have to say, well, I'm going to talk about this man in his hotel and the beach in front of his hotel for 90 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the focus.
Okay, is that the limitations of your meeting, the fact that it's visual, the fact that you have time pressures in terms of doing it in the ministry? That's your deadline pressures?
How long is this program?
This is an hour program.
We're talking about an hour here. We could talk about what we're talking about now for about 4 days.
That's true.
But we got to cut it off on now.
You are
working in the same exact
Correct.
Limitation I work under.
Correct.
Except we are in a dialogue program now that we are going in now. Steve and I work in a program of giving a news story unless it is of such overbearing importance. I don't know what 24 did on the first oil slick story. So we ran 2.5 minutes. That is an extremely long time.
A lively discussion followed when the subject turned to the relationship between the media and the public.
You evidence a consistent pattern in your reporting on such things like oil spills, which do not ask more fundamental questions about economic power and political power.
Well, let's go talk to John Q. Citizen and see how much they give a damn about it.
Well, see, I think you have a very low opinion of the people, and that in some ways probably shapes the way that you present the news, because you do have such a low
Channel
opinion.
Channel 7 right now is running a series on the gay population of the city of Austin.
Okay.
We also spent a 2-week undercover series doing a story on prostitution in the United States.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in the city of Austin.
Uh-huh.
We also ran a major investigative story on Real Couch, if you remember.
Yeah.
All
very
right?
good.
From All we did... for doing those things is have the John Q. public saying we are immoral for talking about prostitution and the problems and the laws abiding it. We are immoral talking about the fact you have a gay population in Austin and that we were insidious and anti-police for talking about Real Couch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you trying to tell me that John Q. public has all these fine, broad, semantic ideals when they call up and we do show that and accuse us of being anti-American, anti-police, and anti-everything else?
You know, you're approaching the subject as if to get to whatever the truth is of the oil blowout in Campeche Bay would require digging, almost going mining for the truth. Couldn't we even just start questioning what the apparent facts as we know it now? whether or not we should pursue
whistleblowers. Well, I think we've done that very clearly for the last 6 months.
Why no connections? William Clements is saying this is all chicken little, this is much ado about nothing, because we have an energy crisis. And that irrespective of the social and environmental consequences of particular energy, we have to go out and get it. Now, why don't you fellas use the Itaco one oil blowout to question, well, is there an energy crisis that we need to pursue these kind of energy sources in the first place?
Let's start with the oil thing. Let's just cut off oil production offshore. That's like looking at you and saying, cut off your head. We have nothing else at the present time. That you might think that's an oil lamp. Now, I'm a reporter. I have spent a lot of my time in the government looking up energy. We don't have anything else at this time. We are indeed in an energy crisis. We are going to have to sit there and face up and say, yeah, we've got other things we've got to start getting out. Like, we do have major coal reserves. We do got sun power. We do got some wind power. In fact, the government's going to build 2 wind power plants here in Texas as a pilot project to make it more efficient. We do have these things. But we can't go on a McCarthy-like scare of industry just because you have one blowout. That didn't happen, by the way, from an American industry. Our rig was involved. But that's not patriotic. It's a little bit of common sense to sit down that the press isn't going to go jumping on everything because one thing happens and then question an entire process that is so necessary to the livelihood of our country at the moment that you cannot look at me and tell me that I've got to go back there and try to destroy it. You can't do that.
Steve then called attention to what he believed was the proper focus, as he calls it, of the oil spill.
Is these hundreds of miles of coastline are being polluted,
okay,
by this black sludge.
So what should we do about it? Should we not stop offshore drilling?
I was sent down there to see what the effect of was on the coast.
Okay. Well, who
I was not sent down there where to answer the question for the United Nations.
Okay, where in our process of government and our process of deliberation and a democratic process and public formation are those questions raised?
Why don't we start with the public? Why don't the public raise the questions? Why do I have to raise the questions?
Well, you're supposed to educate. You're supposed to educate.
No, wrong. I'm supposed to say the facts. If it comes up with something else and it raises a question in somebody's mind, let him get up and say it. And then we can report him saying it.
Well,
you are taking a position right now that we can't take according to law.
According to law, I believe you take positions every night on the news, but you're not owning up the fact that you take positions. You're saying you're just being objective, you're just reporting the news as it is. You're reporting happenings.
A news story is the first draft of history.
Okay.
Very good, Jeff.
That's terrific.
The idea of a news reporter is the facts. It is anti the integrity, it is anti the business, it is anti the history, and it is anti the democracy, and it is anti what the people get up and scream about. If I stand up and say that I think this whole thing is a bunch of BS, and that we ought to stop offshore drilling.
No,
that's what you're asking me to do.
No, I'm not. But what I'm doing, I'm asking you in your penchant for investigative reporting, George and Steve, to look at sources that are beyond the conventional sources. I think you could find people in the Environmental Defense Fund, people who work with Barry Commoner, people who work in the environmental movement, people perhaps a left of center, a little more left than perhaps I'm hearing.
And you can find people who are right of Attila the Hun.
Well, what I'm saying is I think that you're mining in some fairly conventional and safe areas when you look for your sources for news.
Yeah, only because we have a requirement
to
say on two sides.
Did you see
two sides? There's more than two sides in every story, George. There are a lot of stories. And what you seem to think that
can we get 2 more hours on this thing? We might understand the position of a news reporter.
Political observers say the open criticism of the Clements administration is the first heavy salvo of the 1982 political war, a war in which the Democrats hope to regain their historical political dominance. George Waldrop, News 7.
We're very appreciative of our local network affiliates, KVUE, KTBC, and KTVV, for letting us use their video footage. We also like to thank Folk Toy for special technical assistance.